So unfortunately, this drives more migration, climate refugees. This is another signature of climate change. We should expect this to get worse, not better, and it's something that we've seen coming, and it's happening. With regard to the U.S. Claiming that they would pull out of the Paris Agreement, I remember when that news came in over a year ago, and how I think it actually gave more resolve to people who have a job to do, and that's to make a transition to a more sustainable economy. It's like those of us outside of the U.S. are like, okay, well, we have more work to do. Will we get there? Will we meet the Paris Agreement? That's a big question.
Jason Bach, I want to thank you for being with us, professor of glaciology at the Geologic Survey of Denmark and Greenland, speaking to us from Copenhagen. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, it's 5 o'clock p.m. You've been listening to Democracy Now! Here at KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM. At the 5 o'clock hour is the evening news, but we wanted to let you know first that we want to thank the people who gave to our Kickstarter campaign this afternoon: Ernesto, Johanna, Kip, and Anonymous. Please go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter between now and March 9th to help us reach our goal of $20,000. Please give generously and share this campaign with your friends and network on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And check our Kickstarter page. Today we had a live video chat which answers a number of questions people have asked about our campaign. Go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter.
Support our beloved KBOO. Why? Because for 50 years, KBOO has stood by us, helped lift us up, give us a voice, amplified our voice. They have been beside us through thick and thin, through good times and not so good times. In short, they have been beside us as we have lived our lives. That is community radio. In truth, KBOO is really us, all of us. Whether you donate $5 a year or $5,000, or just listen, KBOO is a collective community fabric woven together. It's something to celebrate, to treasure, not just this year, but every year. It's something that every community deserves to have. Invest in the future by supporting us on Kickstarter today. Go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter. And thank you for your support of KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to partner with Good in the Hood, an annual parade and music festival where Portland residents, businesses, and organizations can engage in music, food, and resources while connecting people with experiences that strengthen unity in the community. Good in the Hood is looking for support for their parade, food vendors, information village, marketplace, and kids space. Please contact the Good in the Hood committee to get involved by calling 971-302-6380, go to their website, goodnthehood.org, or you can find more information that can be found at kboo.com/goodinthehood2018.
The time is 5:03, time for the KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the mayor's office held a forum on public safety and the Department of Justice settlement agreement.
A dirty dairy in the gorge is one step closer to a shutdown.
And Burgerville keeps union busting.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, March 1st, 2018. I'm Annette Newell.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. Workers trying to organize at Burgerville continue to battle what they call the company's union-busting tactics. Northwest Labor Press is reporting that Michelle Ceballos, a pro-union Burgerville employee, was fired on February 14th after a manager accused her of stealing a piece of chicken. Michelle, who was featured in a Labor Press story in February, says that the accusation was leveled after she threw away a piece of cold chicken she found lying around. Managers insist they have video of Michelle handling the food and ended her employment. According to Northwest Labor Press, Ms. Ceballos is the fourth employee to be fired in retaliation for their organizing work. Most of the accusations relate to food. One worker was fired for not paying for the dollop of ice cream he put in his free coffee. Another says he accepted a bagel and cream cheese a manager offered to him and then was fired for not paying for it. A fourth man was fired for smelling of cannabis even after he had told management he used medicinal marijuana to treat his epilepsy. Firing workers for union organizing is illegal, but difficult to prove. Northwest Labor Press notes that a company representative would not comment on the matter and that the Burgerville Workers Union, quote, continues to fight and is calling on the public to boycott the company until it deals with the union, end quote.
Having trouble paying that TriMet fare? Well, soon you might be able to do community service instead of paying the $175 fine. On Wednesday, the TriMet Board of Directors approved changes to the fare evasion penalties for adult riders. The new system, which goes into effect on July 1st, will have tiered fines, a community service option, and the ability to waive citations under certain circumstances. Fees can be waived if a rider is eligible for TriMet's Low Income or Honored Citizen program. The rider must enroll in a program within 90 days of getting the citation and then put in at least $10 on a hot fast pass. For those not eligible for a waiver, the first time they are cited for not paying a fare, they'll have to pay a fee of $75. Each citation after that, it'll increase the fine by $25 to a maximum of $175. Opal Environmental Justice Oregon, which advocates for transit-dependent Portlanders, notes that the fine for a parking ticket is $65, lower than the first tier of TriMet's new fee schedule. The community service option will be similarly tiered, starting at 4 hours for the first citation and increasing to 15 hours for the fourth citation. TriMet says they will offer, quote, limited in-person hearings to resolve certain fare evasion citations where valid proof of payment can be documented.
The Army Ranger shot and killed during a training exercise in January in Oregon has been identified as 24-year-old David Kuhn. Kuhn, who was from Philadelphia, was shot by another soldier who was practicing loading the weapon, according to Clatsop County District Attorney John Marquise. Kuhn was shot at the Camp Relea National Guard Base in Warrenton and later died at Columbia Memorial Hospital in Astoria. District Attorney Marquise announced yesterday that he would not file any charges in connection with Kuhn's death. He says there is no indication that this was anything but a tragic accident. According to Marquis, the U.S. Army is conducting its own investigation.
Last night, the mayor's office hosted a forum on public safety and the settlement agreement between the City of Portland and the U.S. Department of Justice. KBOO reporter Sam Bowman was there, and he files this report.
Yesterday evening, about 50 people showed up for a forum on public safety issues hosted by the mayor's office. The forum was held at the Bureau of Development Services building, nestled in the PSU campus on Southwest 4th Avenue. The panel included IPR Director Constantine Severe, Melanie Payne from the city's 911 service, the Bureau of Emergency Communications, Chief of Police Danielle Outlaw, Police Professional Standards Division Commander Steve Jones, Nicole Grant from the Mayor's Office, and Mandy Hood, Project Manager for the city's new Citizen Board, that will oversee the city's compliance with the Department of Justice settlement agreement. Many topics were covered, with the moderator, City Attorney Tracy Reeve, repeatedly refocusing the conversation on the pre-chosen topics, the settlement agreement, and the progress of the new Citizen Board. The audience repeatedly brought up the topics of mental health calls and officer-involved shootings. Constantine Severe, director of the Independent Police Review Division of the City Auditor's Office, got into the weeds about why IPR investigates some cases and not others in response to several different questions. Here he answers a question about what it would mean for IPR to independently investigate officer-involved shootings from Jason Renaud of the Mental Health Association of Portland. Apologies for the poor audio quality throughout this report.
Because officer-involved shootings happen so rarely, that skill set being in one office, it seems a bit complicated and expensive. Would you agree? Or is this something that an IPR should be interested in?
It is, last several years, the city's had around 5 or 6 officer-involved shootings annually. The goal of IPR is to basically follow our mandate as well as, be in compliance with the settlement agreement. I think ultimately the goal of what we're doing here is that whether it's IPR or is the police bureau doing a mystery investigation around an officer-involved shooting, is that it's an investigation that objectively stands on its merits. It is a quality investigation. It's non-biased. It asks and answers all questions, and that an outside entity could take a look at that investigation and say, it is a solid, good investigation.
Portland's police chief of 5 months, Danielle Outlaw, sat up front for a brief but candid Q&A. At one point, Donna Hayes, whose grandson Quanis Hayes was killed by Portland police officer Andrew Hurst last February, confronted Outlaw about the trend of officers who kill being promoted or given awards, sometimes explicitly for their actions that resulted in someone's death. She pointed out that Officer Hurst and 2 others had already been given awards after the shooting death of Merle Hatch at Adventist Hospital in 2013.
Now that Hurst has shot my grandson, I was wondering if this is going to happen again.
So again, I can't speak on what happened before I got here.
I understand that, but...
And I am a firm... I can see how that could be very insensitive. Very insensitive. I don't come from a place where you give awards for taking someone's life. I firmly believe that no one wins when this happens. There's a substantial impact on, obviously, family. And then there's an impact on the officer and the bureau and the community. So it's not something that you put up as a trophy on top of the fireplace to parade around and say, look at what I've done, if that makes sense. And it's little things like that. It's little, but it's not, So I step in and I say, what are some of the smallest things that we can do to have the largest impact? Little things like that, and just being sensitive, I think also lends to what your original question was.
Nicole Grant is Mayor Wheeler's senior policy advisor. She pointed out that the mayor's office is running these meetings until the new citizen board is active this summer.
These interim kind of meetings as a placeholder before kind of PSEP is established are being hosted by the mayor's office, but I want to be really clear that PSEP, the Portland Committee on Community Engaged Policing, will be hosted by the PSEP. We're looking for this to be community-driven, right? So we're stepping away, the mayor's office is stepping away. Mandy Hood is the project director, and she has been spearheading the development. Mandy is fantastic.
Well, she gets mental health.
And she
She's
does.
One in the city that really does.
So that was a very intentional choice.
The PSEP is currently in the doldrums as the city waits to hear bids for a facilitator position, someone to shepherd the committee as it develops so as to avoid the poor setup and sense of futility that led to the collapse and rejection by the mayor of the Community Oversight Advisory Board early last year. Since that board stopped meeting, the city has been out of compliance with the settlement agreement, which stipulates that there must be a community oversight body for the whole process. Last night's forum, and monthly forums following from it, are theoretically filling the gap. Once the PSEP has a facilitator, the mayor hopes to have its positions filled by June and the board active by July. There was some appreciation in the room for the opportunity to address these issues, and many topics were suggested for next month: treatment of houseless people, anti-stalking orders against cop watchers, armed police at mental health facilities, and so on. Despite the emphasis on regaining public trust, not everyone in the room felt that the forum served its purpose. Jason Renaud of the Mental Health Association of Portland pointed out that the only new information he heard last night was that Chief Outlaw has still not met with the city's grassroots mental health community.
That is an injury right there.
A fairness hearing on the settlement agreement is scheduled for April 19th. The date of the March Community Forum has yet to be announced. For Cable Evening News, I'm Sam Bowman.
A mega dairy farmer in North Central Oregon is on the verge of having to shut down after repeated failures to prevent livestock waste from spilling into drinking water. Lost Valley Farm is along the Columbia River near Boardman and the Lower Umatilla Basin groundwater management area. The roughly 30,000 cows living on the farm supply milk that eventually ends up in Tillamook cheese. The farm's wastewater permit allows as much as 187 million gallons of manure per year. But since the dairy opened in 2017, inspectors have repeatedly recorded leaks at the facility. After fines and citations failed to improve the leaks that endanger community drinking water, the Oregon Department of Agriculture filed a suit to stop the dairy from producing any more wastewater. Lost Valley has been the subject of community protests since it first applied for a permit and has been at the center of several scandals, including the arrest of the owner, Greg Teveld, for soliciting prostitution and possession of meth last August. In response to the Department of Agriculture's suit, Veld said that the inspectors were just being hard on him and that closing the dairy would result in the cows' deaths and the layoffs of 70 employees.
And now it's time for Labor History in Two from Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1936. That was the day Hoover Dam was formally turned over to the federal government. It was a massive undertaking. Approved by the Coolidge administration in 1928, work began to divert and then dam the Colorado River in 1931, creating Lake Mead. Thousands of unemployed flocked to the area in search of jobs. More than 21,000 were employed over the course of 5 years, with as many as 5,200 working on any given day. Workers were paid on average of 50 cents an hour, with higher pay for skilled work. Governmental hiring terms included preference to veterans and no hiring of Asians. The Colored Citizens Labor and Protective Association of Las Vegas protested de facto hiring discrimination against blacks. Their eventual representation among the employed totaled an estimated 24 to 30 for the duration of the project. A few Native Americans were hired as high scalers to remove loose rock with jackhammers and dynamite. Estimated fatalities ranged from 96 to over 150. Many died from falls, heat-related illnesses, falling debris, heavy equipment, and carbon monoxide poisoning from tunnel work. The project was rocked by at least 2 documented strikes. The industrial workers of the world attempted to organize there. Workers struck over wage cuts and working conditions. They repeatedly demanded flushing toilets and cold, clean running water, especially in temperatures as high as 120 degrees in the summertime. At the time the Hoover Dam was turned over to the federal government, it was the tallest dam and the largest hydroelectric station in the country. It currently generates about 4 billion kilowatt hours of hydroelectric power for Nevada, Arizona, and California. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Now for the weekly riddle, the point puzzle from KPOV High Desert Radio in Bend. Those of you who missed the puzzle on Tuesday, fear not. It will return to its normal spot next week. The theme of today's puzzle is wordplay, or is wordplay, spices, and clothing.
It's time for the puzzle.
Last week, I asked you for the next number in this series. 2, 16, 54, 128. Well, the answer is 250. Each of the numbers is 2 times a perfect cube in sequence. One user also figured out how to calculate the amount added each time and came to the correct answer that way. And finally, if you visited the Point Puzzle webpage, some of you noticed that this was puzzle number 250, and the answer was a celebration of our 250 weeks of puzzling. Our winner this week is Rolf Semperbon, who listens to KBOO in Portland, Oregon. For the new puzzle, write down a spice, draw a single line segment, and you will have an article of clothing. Additionally, the two words don't rhyme. So again, write down a spice, draw a single line segment in the word, and you will now have an article of clothing. Send your name, your answer, and the station on which you hear the puzzle to puzzle@kpov.org. I'll select one winner from among any answers received by this Saturday.
Are you going to Scarborough Fair? Parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme.
This has been Pearl Stark with your Point Puzzle for the week of February 26th. The Point Puzzle is produced at KPOV High Desert Community Radio.
It is now 5:19, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Breaking news, Trump and company are a murderous mob. Specifically, they've been serial killers of the English language. The word fact was their first victim, assassinated last year by one of Trump's mobsters who poisoned it with a toxic substance named alternative fact. Their latest hit was a celebrated word from the literary world, satire. It embodies the artful use of sarcasm and ridicule to expose the vanity and vice of public figures. But Trump himself killed satire by starving it of any meaning. How can anyone satirize a presidency that is, in reality, nothing but a fully staged satire of vanity and vice? Satire involves exaggerating the flaws, mannerisms, etc. of various characters to convey how corrupt and contemptible they are. But it's impossible to exaggerate the awfulness of an administration that gleefully flaunts its awfulness every day. Take Trump's proposed budget. Please, delivered just in time for Valentine's Day, it's a stab to the heart of poor people, intentionally increasing poverty and hunger across our country. It would slash programs providing essential food, housing, and even heating assistance for about 50 million Americans, mostly children, old folks, poverty wage workers, and disabled people. Then there's Medicare and Medicaid, which most working-class Americans count on. Candidate Trump promised us that, quote, there will be no cuts in funding for these programs. But his Valentine budget features, guess what, hundreds of billions of dollars in cuts to Medicare and Medicaid. Not only has his cynicism killed satire, but his cynical health care cuts could also kill you. This is Jim Hightower saying, presidential budgets aren't just numbers. They're statements of a president's moral principles. No work of satire could ridicule Trump's morality as effectively as his own budget.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report as KBOO talks to Senator Ron Wyden and Congresswoman Suzanne Bonamici about the opioid epidemic, immigration, and gun control. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, it's By Ear to the Streets of Portland. At 10, on Autonomy Hour, Kathy plays eclectic tunes from near and far. Tonight's weather in the Portland metro will be a mix of rain and snow showers with a low of 33. Today in history, in 1987, Congress designated March as Women's History Month. Also on this day in 1864, Rebecca Lee Crumpler became the first African-American woman to earn a medical degree in the U.S. She then spent her professional career working with women and children, including former slaves, providing care free of charge. The quote of the day is from the introduction to A Book of Medical Discourses, which Dr. Crumpler published in 1883. Quote, "People do not wish to feel that death ensues through neglect on their part. They seem to forget that there is a cause for every ailment. At that, it may be in their power to remove it. My chief desire in presenting this book is to impress upon somebody's mind the possibilities of prevention." End quote. Thank you.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture. On today's report, grants fight food waste, a new institute opens in New Mexico, and an intersectional conference looks at climate change.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Coquel Tribe is announcing a $20,000 grant that'll help increase and diversify food programs. KLCC's Brian Bull reports.
A number of grocery stores currently donate to what's called Fresh Alliance. The program collects expired baked goods, fruits, and vegetables, and other items to redistribute to food banks. With this latest grant, McKay's will join the list, which also includes Safeway and Walmart. Jackie Chambers coordinates the Coquel Tribal Fund. She says while the food is past its sell-by date, it's still safe and healthy for families who'd otherwise go without it.
Something that's very important to the tribe is potlatch, and that's always giving back and leaving some for others. So this grant is going to help to eliminate throwing out food waste.
Chambers says altogether, 58 groups are sharing nearly $300,000 in grants this year. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
A new institute was launched in New Mexico this week to help empower Native communities. Cheryl Fairbanks is the Native American Budget and Policy Institute's interim director. She says the institute will work with community members, university scholars and students, tribal leaders, and others.
This institute is going to be solution-oriented. Rather than the Indian problem, it's going to be the Indian solution. We have a governing council of very esteemed individuals who have expertise in law, medicine, environment, as well as their own indigenous knowledge.
One of the first activities is a series of meetings to focus on incorporating culture, tradition, and healing into justice systems. Indigenous people, scientists, and legal experts recently gathered at the University of New Mexico to discuss climate change, environmental protection, and development in the Arctic. Ken Tape, research professor at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, spoke about changes scientists have seen in Alaska.
From glaciers, sea ice, changes in vegetation, thawing of the frozen ground that we call permafrost, and also changes in wildlife. A lot of things that you would expect if you get 100 years worth of warming. What happens in the Arctic doesn't stay in the Arctic. You know, this is a global climate that we are dealing with. And so when you see this ice albedo feedback, for example, so you see increased warming in the polar regions, that is tied to climate down here. So yeah, it gets warmer in Alaska, and it's getting drier and warmer in the Southwest. And so those things are linked.
Gwich'in people talked about work to protect the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge from development under Trump administration plans. Much of the work includes educating the public about the area and the caribou Gwich'in people rely on, says Bernadette Dementif with the Gwich'in Steering Committee.
We're going to be doing more outreach locally and nationally. We will be also be going to the United Nations Forum, just basically going after probably more corporation, because this is the last untouched, unspoiled ecosystem in the world. And, you know, it's just not just for us. What happens in the Arctic is going to happen down this way. You know, we have to be concerned. It's time, right now is the time for us to take a stand. That's when it's too late.
Dementif says the Gwich'in Nation is not giving up or backing down in efforts to protect the wildlife refuge from oil and gas drilling. Well-known Native American author Sherman Alexie released a statement Wednesday as pressure mounted from accusations of sexual harassment. The accusations from one named woman and several anonymous sources surfaced on social media in recent days. The award-winning writer of books, including The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian, apologized for hurting people, saying there are women telling the truth about his behavior, but Alexie did not expand on any details. He also rejected accusations by the woman named who he says were consenting sexual partners. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation.
The Senate is still looking for a fix for Dreamers, though Monday's Supreme Court decision reduced the urgency for lawmakers to decide the fates of immigrants brought to the U.S. illegally as children. Congress had been facing a March 5th deadline due to President Trump's decision to end the immigration program, affecting close to 700,000 kids. But the court ruling saves the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, recipients until the issue at least goes to the U.S. Court of Appeals Ninth Circuit. Republican Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona has been in talks with Democratic Senator Heidi Heitkamp from North Dakota about a plan to tie a 3-year extension of DACA with about a $700.6 billion for border security. The Trump administration announced last year it would end the Obama-era program. Months of closed-door negotiations have failed to produce a deal. Find out what Oregon Senator Ron Wyden and Congresswoman Susan Bonamici have to say about the DACA dilemma later on this hour.
Outcasting Overtime features essays and discussions from Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program, Outcasting. In this episode, Outcasting youth participant Lauren talks about her search for a label for her sexuality.
This is Outcasting Overtime, a special feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Hi, I'm Lucas, a youth participant in Outcasting's main studio in Westchester County, New York. On this edition, Outcaster Lauren talks about her experiences with labels. Labels can be helpful for some and limiting for others. Lauren, like many LGBTQ youth, had difficulty with labels when she was first coming to terms with her sexuality.
When I was 12 years old, I had a crush on a girl. I'd never liked a girl until then, and I did not know how to handle it. Some people come out immediately after they realize that they like people of their own gender. A woman might realize that she has fallen in love with another woman, everything will click into place at once, and she will come out as a lesbian the next day. But for most people, it's a slower process, especially when you're in middle school. I was lucky enough to know that there were words for girls who liked other girls, and I was lucky enough to know that I wasn't the only one. But things didn't make sense immediately. I didn't know whether I was one of those girls, or if this was just a one-time thing. I didn't know whether I still liked guys either. All I knew was that I liked girls, or one girl, meaning that I was not straight. So I started to come out to friends as not straight. But it turns out it is quite difficult to come out as not something. People want to know more than that. Was I gay, bi, pan, or some other label that I had never heard of? I tried on the different labels as if they were shirts, but nothing seemed to fit right. I made scales in my head, counted up crushes I'd had on girls and crushes I'd had on boys. I tried to place myself on the Kinsey scale or as a percentage, as if you could really be 75% gay. I felt like I needed a label. There had been a few times that I had told people that I liked a girl, and they thought that I was just joking or I just thought that she was pretty. I thought that I needed a label to be legitimate. A year or two later, I stumbled upon the word queer online. The general definition of it that I found was not straight. But if you called yourself queer, you were no longer speaking in negatives. People from across the LGBTQ spectrum called themselves queer, and people like me, who were trying to figure out who they were but couldn't put a word on it yet, called themselves queer. If labels were shirts, queer was a big, comfortable one. I started to call myself queer. The first reaction that I got from this was negative. I had come out to an older person in my life who asked me, "Why would you ever call yourself that?" I felt ashamed, like maybe I was hurting people without knowing that I was. So I did what I enjoy doing most. I researched. Queer is actually a really interesting word. There are a few theories about where the word comes from, but one theory is that it comes from a Proto-Indo-European root that I can't even pronounce. T-E-R-K-W. It means to twist, turn, wind, or cut. So it could be said that queer meant not straight before straight meant heterosexual. The word went through a few linguistic changes before eventually becoming the Scottish word queer. It gained the meaning of different, although it usually meant different in a bad or strange way. Around the beginning of the 20th century, it began to mean homosexual. And by the mid-20th century, it solidified its definition as homosexual in a derogatory way. So, when did things change? In the 1980s, the activist group Queer Nation emerged. The group hoped to be shocking. They believed that it was necessary at that point in time. They also wanted to reclaim the word queer, to take it back from the people who had used it against them. The slogan, "We're here, we're queer, get used to it," became popular, and queer studies became an academic field. Older LGBT people often have negative feelings towards the word, as it was used frequently to bully them in their youth. But for me and many young people, this experience was not shared. The first time that I heard the word queer, it was from the LGBT community, while I mostly heard gay used as an insult growing up. That doesn't mean that the word carries no historical weight. Everything does, and it is understandable that it causes pain to some people. But it can be helpful, too. My current feeling about it is this. I can use it to refer to myself, but not anyone else. I also started to refer to myself as bisexual, which has felt more comfortable as time has gone on. But another thing has changed, too. As I've grown up and become more confident, I felt less and less that I need a label. It is helpful to have, for coming out and for dating, but at this point it doesn't feel as important as it used to. I will use one label for months, I will switch among three in the same conversation, I will tire of words completely and just kind of exist. A label can change what people see, but for me, it no longer has the power to change what's on the inside.
Thanks for listening to Outcasting Overtime, a special feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program.
Climate Connections is a daily podcast that focuses on how climate change affects our daily lives.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Each winter, logging trucks rumble in and out of Wisconsin forests, harvesting trees that will be converted into paper, furniture, and other wood products.
Winter has traditionally been the core time for timber harvesting.
Adina Rissman of the University of Wisconsin in Madison studies the logging industry. She says hard, frozen ground makes it easier to move equipment in and out of forests without getting stuck in the mud or damaging soil and roads. But winters in Wisconsin are warming.
We can clearly demonstrate over the last 50 years a 2 to 3 week shortening of the frozen ground season. And that's just on average. I mean, some years have very little to no frozen ground. If your winter is mud instead of ice, then it's difficult or impossible to get the job done.
Rissman says that to adapt, loggers can invest in equipment better suited for wet conditions or compete for high demand jobs in drier areas. But these changes cost money, and Rissman says the added expense can be a strain for loggers working in an industry that's already stressed by global competition and a changing market. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Immigrants and asylum seekers are protesting in the UK, including women on a hunger strike. Al Jazeera News reports there are about 400 people at the Yarlswood Immigration Removal Center north of London, most of them women. The government sent them there because it says it wants to confirm their IDs or work on their immigration claims. But dozens of the detainees say they're victims of a government detention policy which allows migrants and asylum seekers to be held indefinitely at 9 centers across the UK. More than 100 women vowed to go on a hunger strike Monday to pressure leaders to change back to a 28-day limit on immigration detention, and politicians have begun debating the situation. A Labour Party official calls it desperate, and a Liberal Democrat asks the government what steps it had taken to resolve it. Meanwhile, the ruling Conservative Party says the detainees could be refusing food for dietary and religious reasons, and the private company running the camps claims there is no hunger strike underway.
APT-28, also known as Fancy Bear, is a Russian hacking firm with suspected ties to the Russian government. They are currently top suspects of having hacked into the DNC during the 2016 elections, as well as the German parliament in 2015. As of recently, they have reportedly hacked into German intelligence files. Moscow denies that they are tied to this group in any way. The malware used to hack into German intelligence could have been present for over a year, but wasn't discovered until December of last year. The damage has so far been called quite considerable. Germany's Minister of the Interior stated that the attack had been contained and is under investigation. The news of this story was broke by German media agency DPA. The fact that the Intelligence Oversight Committee members only heard about the security breach from the news has left many feeling outraged. Armin Schuster, a chairman for the Intelligence Oversight Committee, stated that, quote, "It's an ongoing attack, and therefore public discussions about details would simply be a warning to the attacker, which we don't want to give." Dieter Janicek, the head of the Digital Affairs Committee from the Greens Party, stated that, quote, If it turns out that to be true, it is a form of warfare against Germany, end quote.
Venezuela launched its own cryptocurrency last week. The new commodity-backed petro coin reportedly raised $735 million in its first day. The petro, backed by 5 billion barrels of Venezuela's oil, has been called illegal by the country's opposition party. The United States warns that purchasing the coin could violate sanctions against the country, which prohibit purchasing new Venezuelan debt. Meanwhile, it remains unclear whether the proceeds from the coin offering will do anything to alleviate the hunger and suffering that is causing hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans to flee into neighboring countries. Brazil recently declared a state of emergency due to the influx of starving migrants. For the past few weeks, thousands of people have crossed the border every day. Most who enter on foot are camping in public squares, looking for work and getting food from government trucks. Now, small Brazilian cities are struggling to support their citizens as well as the migrants. The United Nations, which has teams in Brazil, says it considers the Venezuelan migrants to be refugees.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Sam Bowman, Grace Ann Smith, Annette Newell, and Jasmine Moneymaker. The producer is Jasmine Moneymaker. Our engineer is Sam Bowman. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchand. The podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Grace Ann Smith.
And I'm Annette Newell. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Positively Revolting. Ani takes your calls. At 9, Pacific Underground, a show for and by Asian and Pacific Islander communities in the Northwest. At 10, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, a Radio Geekly discusses all things geek. KBOO's Kickstarter is live. Go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter and help KBOO build a city of media makers. That's kboo.fm/Kickstarter.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
With the opioid crisis deepening nationwide, local governments have begun taking action to stem the tide of addiction-related deaths. In Oregon, Multnomah County filed a $250 million lawsuit against Purdue Pharma and other opioid manufacturers. Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler says three Oregonians die each week due to the pain-killing drugs, and now the City Council has also decided to take legal action. KBOO's Annette Newell spoke with the Senator Ron Wyden and Congresswoman Bonamici about the opioid problem as well as gun control and immigration.
Opioid addiction and how to fight it. That was the issue that brought together a group of lawmakers, doctors, former addicts, treatment pros, and law enforcement leaders at a recent town hall at Central City Concern in Portland. I spoke with Democratic Oregon U.S. Senator Ron Wyden right after the event, and he says the need to find a solution is dire and urgent.
We do have to do a whole lot in a hurry. And part of what I heard today reflects priorities. There was a $1.5 trillion tax cut, largely for multinational corporations and those at the top of the economic, period. And all I could think of as I heard today, for example, about the need for prevention, as I heard about the need for mental health, just a tiny, tiny fraction of what has gone to multinational corporations who are already awash in money and who are using most of what they've gotten primarily for stock buybacks. Had that money gone here, it would have made a lot bigger difference in the lives of a lot of people who, with a modest role as it relates to prevention and mental health, could get on with their lives.
You talked a lot about trying to find solutions that both Republicans and Democrats can get behind. Is that a special challenge, and is this an especially contentious time?
The reality is neither side has enough votes in a 51-49 United States Senate to have it their way. So if you want to build sustainable solutions, you've got to find a way to have some common ground. So when that gentleman talked about character building, as soon as I heard that, I said, that'll really be helpful to me as I reach out to try to build support for services that require a real role that maybe a Republican wouldn't naturally gravitate to. But if he hears that services and character building, it might be more appealing.
Wyden also talked about the issue of gun control in the wake of the tragic school shooting in Florida.
Well, what I can tell you is I voted against military assault weapons before, and I certainly would vote for it again. I just hope we can have broader, you know, reform. For example, if you have reform now, today, there's still an unbelievable number of guns out there right now. So what I'm going to be pushing for is a airtight, loophole-free, universal background check so that every time a gun is sold in America, gun show, private sale, what have you, there has to be a background check. Because unless you have something like that, you're not beginning to touch all the guns that are already out there. And that's what we've got to do.
What do you think of the president's suggestion of arming school personnel?
I believe teachers are trained to teach. And law enforcement people are those that we ought to be funding in and around schools to do the incredible, important safety work that they're doing. And here we are on Friday afternoon. The president has recommended arming teachers. And my sense is, what's he going to suggest next? Is he going to say tomorrow morning in a tweet that we ought to arm ministers and that in addition to their Bibles and robes, they ought to bring a Glock? I don't know what we'll hear tomorrow.
What do you think of what's going on with the Mueller investigation, by the way?
Bob Mueller's doing it by the book. I've worked with him often. He's a decorated war hero. He's worked with Democrats and Republicans. He works on the criminal side. I'm leading the follow the money fight in the Senate Intelligence Committee, which we have the job to tell the narrative to the American people how our democracy was hacked. And I can just tell you, as long as I'm Oregon's guy on the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, this Russia matter isn't going to get swept under the rug.
Okay, and one question about the DACA kids. I know you've been working really hard to find a solution for the 11,000-plus DACA kids in Oregon. Anything new there?
Well, what was so unfortunate about the votes is the president basically said, look, it's my way or the highway, or we'll just harm all these young people who grew up in Oregon and at the same time harm the economy in the effort to create more jobs, because a lot of these young people have talents that can do that. A lot of us were willing to compromise. I will tell you, I detest the idea of a wall because it runs contrary to everything I know from a family where my parents fled the Nazis and all my dad wanted to do was to serve in our army. He's the most patriotic guy who ever lived. And he wanted to drop the propaganda pamphlets on the Nazis, telling them they ought to give up, and it was hopeless. So I was willing to compromise on something I just detest, which is the wall, in order to really end the injustice against Dreamers. And that still wasn't enough for the Trump administration. So the fight goes on again next week. We are going to stay at it until we get justice for the Dreamers.
Next, I talked to Oregon's 1st District Democratic Congresswoman Suzanne Bonamici. First, about the conversation she just heard on the opioid epidemic and its impact on Oregonians.
Congresswoman, hi. My name is Annette Newell. I've talked to you before.
Oh, of course. Nice to see you.
So, overall, did you come away with some good ideas from this?
I did. It was helpful, as have been the conversations. This is my 7th conversation in Northwest Oregon about the opioid epidemic, and having this many people here from different perspectives was helpful, especially looking at both the short-term and the long-term needs in the community to address this crisis, focusing on prevention, but also understanding that we need more treatment and more opportunities for people right now to save lives.
But she says this time, the ideas about prevention were different from what she's heard in the past.
The prevention discussion here was more comprehensive. Prevention in the other discussions has been about prescription practices and changing prescription practices. And Oregon is still doing better now than we were. The total number is decreased, but if you took the number, it would still be everybody in Oregon getting 55 pills, and that includes adults and children. So prevention is about more than changing prescription practices. It's about making sure that starting early, young kids growing up have a sense of community. It was great to hear from the people in recovery talking about what a difference that would have made for them, making sure that they're connected, and really looking at the, it's called adverse health indicators, I believe, or adverse childhood experiences. If we can look at those and make decisions early on about when students need either health care, mental health care, just things as simple as an after-school program so that they stay in a community, those are really good investments. Unfortunately, the Trump administration is proposing cutting a lot of those. For example, the funding for the 21st Century Learning Programs, which are extended learning opportunities for before and after school, those are very, very good investments. If we can keep kids in school, we keep them out of the criminal justice system, and we can keep them away from needing safety net services. So I'll be fighting for those investments, as well as the more immediate need for more treatments and making sure that people have access to treatment that they need.
There's been so much talk about gun control in the wake of the horrible tragedy in Florida. So I wanted to get your take on what some possible solutions to that might be and what Oregon's doing.
Thank you. Well, Oregon is ahead of many other states. However, I have to say this has been a devastating issue to watch it play out in communities from Sandy Hook to Umpqua Community College to Clackamas Town Center to Pulse to Las Vegas to the church in Texas and now to the high school in Florida. And that's just a short list of too many tragic, tragic deaths from gun violence. And there are many things that we can be doing. We could start with universal background checks, which we don't have now. We could raise the age for people to get guns. We can make sure that the criminal background check system is working, and we can say we don't need people to access assault weapons. That doesn't violate anybody's constitutional right to say you don't have to have a weapon of war with these huge magazines on the street. So it's a conversation we have to have. We had an assault weapons ban for about 10 years. It expired. We need to revisit that conversation, as well as the other issues I mentioned. One thing we should not do is arm teachers. Adding guns into schools is definitely the wrong approach. It would make students less safe. It would make the teachers less safe, because when first responders come in, if somebody's shooting a gun, they don't know that that's the teacher. It puts the teachers in danger. It puts the students in danger. There are many things we can do to keep students safe at school. Arming teachers is not one of them.
Congresswoman Bonamici also praised the students who have become more vocal in the wake of the Florida school shooting.
It's pretty amazing.
She maintains that it's positive that the students are speaking out and demanding change on gun policy.
Absolutely. And for those students in Florida, and here, even in Oregon, they're stepping up, they're speaking out. To see them be so engaged and so passionate about their safety, but also understanding that they don't want to live in a violent society and violent communities, it's really inspiring to see their confidence. They're so brave and so passionate. And having got, especially the students in Florida who have just gone through this extremely traumatic experience that will be with them the rest of their lives, to see them step up and make change is really heartening. And I think they're going to make a difference. I hope they do, because they don't want any other student to go through what they just went through in Florida. I can't imagine what it was like for them. I mean, I'm a mom. My kids are grown. But I can't imagine being a parent and not knowing if your child was lying dead on the floor or huddled in the back of a closet. It's devastating. There's no reason why we have to have this with so many access, so too much access to these weapons of war. We need to put an end to it.
Yeah, my mom's a teacher in Florida, so she knew some of the people in
school. Oh, my gosh.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's just devastating.
Do you mind if I ask you about immigration?
No, okay. That's fine.
If okay.
Do I have
immigration reform?
Yeah, like one more minute.
Okay, I'll just ask you a quick question about DACA. It's on the table. I know you've been fighting really hard on that.
Absolutely.
Issue. As well, any signs of a solution or anything?
Well, there are conversations about a solution. There are bipartisan bills that would protect DACA recipients who are, you know, as you know, people who were brought here as children, mm-hmm. Oftentimes working, studying, contributing to our community. It's the only country they've ever known. So I'm fighting hard to make sure that they're protected. What the administration ends up demanding in exchange for that protection remains to be seen. I certainly want to do all I can to make sure those DACA recipients can stay in the country. I had Miriam Corona, Vargas Corona as my guest for the State of the Union. She's a wonderful young woman who spent 26 and a half of her 27 years here in the United States. She's graduated from college. She has a wonderful husband and son. And she said to me, I don't know how to prepare myself to be taken away from my husband and my child and sent back to a country I don't know. So I think about her and all the dreamers I've met, and I'm going to fight for them.
Yeah, and a deadline's coming up next month.
March 5th is a deadline, however. Yeah. There's some courts that have stayed enforcement, so I hope we can do something by March 5th, but I'll keep fighting.
Okay. All right, thank you for your time. Yeah. Appreciate it so much. Thank you.
And those are my conversations with Oregon Congresswoman Suzanne Bonamici and Oregon U.S. Senator Ron Wyden in Portland at the Central City Concern Town Hall. Annette Newell, KBOO News In Depth.
No classrooms, no teachers, no students at KBOO. Only community members sharing their skills with one another and passing on what they've learned from another DJ to the next generation of programmers. We believe that all have something to teach and we all have something to learn. Knowledge should be free to access. Your support for KBOO ensures this. Help us build a city of artistic media makers. Long live DIY Radio and join us on Kickstarter today.
Go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter. Donate to the campaign and share it with your friends. And thank you for your support of KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Resolve to Resist, Session 2, Thursday, March 8th at 5:30 p.m. at the Multicultural Service Center in Portland. Resolve to Resist Session 2 is about running for elected positions. Panelists will address what it means to be a candidate, how to get started, and how to bring attention to the needs and issues too often overlooked in our political system. Child care and light refreshments will be provided. Again, that's Resolve to Resist Session 2, Thursday, March 8th at 5:30 p.m. at the Multicultural Service Center. That's 4610 Southeast Belmont Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5:58. Coming up next, Rose City Native Radio.